In this time of aging empires and of fruitless opinions, it can only be helpful to reconsider the reflections of those who would show us ways of avoiding the storm of excess that presently devours our civilization. E.F. Schumacher was such a one. In much of his work, Schumacher looked for ways of restoring rhythm and balance in our dealings with each other and with an earth that has been sorely damaged by industrial civilization and its destructive technologies. Very early in the piece, Schumacher demolished the myth of limitless growth as the natural destiny of economies and of nations. The common sense spoken by Schumacher is nowhere to be seen in the economic and political style of the present day. There has been little, if any, change in the way things are done since he delivered his message over 30 years ago. A deep aesthetic is expressed in Schumacher's thought. He continually returns to the criteria of beauty, of elegance, of non-violence, and of human scale in his pursuit of a workable future for humanity during a time of growing uncertainties. E.F. Schumacher remains an enduring source of wisdom in an age of madness and folly.
Today the vocabulary is that anyone who calls black, black is called a pessimist, and anyone who calls black, white is called an optimist. But in the real sense, what we need is optimistic pessimists. That's to say, people who know that beyond any argument now, if they know their onions, if they know any of the real facts, no one can argue with me as far as the fuel situation is concerned. No one can really argue with an experienced ecologist as far as the ecological situation is concerned. So in that respect, if you like to call a chap who says things are pretty dark, if you call him a pessimist, in that sense I'm a pessimist. But I'm an optimistic pessimist because I believe that there are now lots of things going on that make change possible. Materially, it's no real problem. We can live on a small fraction of what we're living now, as the culture of poverty, wherever it has existed, has amply demonstrated. The great thing about the really optimistic pessimists is that they're not work shy. And they don't stay at the level of talk, talk, talk. They actually get their hands dirty and do some work. Let's hope we can all graduate to that class. Very few people at the rich end, few as a proportion of total humanity, cannot possibly be a model for the world as a whole. And unless we find a new model, we're just going to drift deeper and deeper into disaster. The rich society norm, whether you say to the world at large, if only you will adopt our technology and our methods, you can all live like little Americans or little Western Europeans or little Japanese. That is just plain nonsense. It can't be. A different model is required. We might say a culture of poverty. So we have the people who say we must change the system. And they're quite right. Except one never knows what they mean. Society has produced this production system. But now, the system molds society. It insists that every member of society respects the immanent logic of the system and adapts to it by accepting, and that's the only way you can adapt, by accepting its implicit aims as one's own. And in this sense, man becomes captive of the system, whether he approves of its aims or not. And he cannot effectively adopt different aims and values, unless he takes steps to alter the system of production. The prevailing concept of efficiency rules the modern world, not by itself. It rules it by the type of technology and the type of organization it has produced. In other words, unless and until somebody has got to work and has produced new technologies, new types of organization, until that has happened, all the preaching, which is also necessary, all the appeal to people's goodness, their good sense, their ethical, spiritual qualities, all this will invariably stay inside the system and will be powerless to alter the system. It will not be altered unless there is an incarnation. That's to say, unless some people actually have got to work to produce new types of work, new types of organization, new patterns of consumption, new patterns of distribution of the population. Have produced this and have shown it to be viable. And that's very hard work. For work, we have to have some guidelines, some orientation. And if we've come to the conclusion, as I've come to the conclusion, that these now suicidal tendencies of the modern world, quite apart from their disastrous spiritual implications, could be summed up in four criteria. But any such listing is, to some extent, personal and arbitrary. But I would sum it up like this. First of all, the tendency towards giantism, economies of scale, all that. Secondly, all these are closely interconnected, the tendency towards an unbelievable complexity. No doubt you have seen cars where progress was represented by the fact that you did not have to subject yourself to the indignity of turning a little handle to wind the windows up and down. You pressed a button and zzz, they went up. These things, of course, break down and then cost a lot to repair. And the simplest things one can't do oneself anymore. Everything has become too complex. Vast expense in terms of capital. You have to have immense amounts of capital to start, to do anything, and a tendency towards ever-increasing violence in the very production processes, from which it follows that if we want to do this work, to incarnate a more humane, a more Christian idea of carrying on, we would have to look at least in the opposite directions, but not only look with our eyes, but also with our hands. Can't we make things small again, reduce them to the human scale, get away from this giantism? Does it have to be so complex? Can't we revise our whole ideas of our pattern of consumption in the direction of simplicity? I'm not saying 100%, because it's the direction that matters. Can't we use our brilliant technology to evolve methods of production where even a little fellow can help himself, and doesn't, you don't have to be rich or powerful in order even to start? And can't we go systematically, determinedly, in the direction of non-violence rather than violence? Only with the help of such knowledge and such technology, and it's only not only hardware, it's also software, can we create a system that would serve man in the place of the present system, which enslaves him. We are not using the facilities the Creator has put at our disposal for the purpose of attaining an end. We don't even make up our mind what our end is. We are using them, well, because they're there. Our engineers and scientists produce something more we could do, so we must do it. It's got nothing to do with any clear purpose of man to save a soul or anything else, to land people on the moon. Or if someone has come to such a condition that his heart is totally ruined, to make a heart transplant. Or etc., etc., etc. But we do it because it's possible to do. It's a society that is rich in means and poor in purposes. Unity is difficult to attain. It's very difficult to attain inside ourselves. Even a saint like St. Paul had to struggle against this lack of unity inside himself. For the good that I would, I do not. But the evil which I would not, that I do. O wretched man that I am. With the mind, I myself serve the law of God. With the flesh, the law of sin. So, this has something to do with God, with unity. And the diversity and multiplicity has something to do with our earth. And uniformity has something to do with hell.
It raises the question of the influence of technology on the whole situation. Is it appropriate to what we really want to do? Now, my own view is that one of the most important things in our culture is a modicum of democratic freedom. Now, is our gigantic and immensely expensive technology relevant to or conducive to democratic freedom? The answer is no, it is not. It is conducive to the development of great concentrations of economic power and the kind of predictions that have been made that in the year 2000 some 50 multinational companies will be doing 90% of the economic work of the world. Well, that is not very democratic. So from this point of view, we do not currently have an appropriate technology for maintenance of democratic freedom.
And what interests me most, and has been interesting me for quite a long time, is to mobilize more and more intellectual forces to create a technology for the people. The technological development of the last 50 years has gone away from the people. Everything has become so big, so complex, so costly, and also so violent that only very big corporations can handle it. And ordinary people are left out. They can go around looking for a job, for some slot to fit themselves into. But if there aren't enough slots, then they've had it.
I used to like to go to work, but they shut it down. I got a right to go to work, but there's no work here to be found. Yes, and they say, we're gonna have to pay what's owed. We're gonna have to reap from some seed that's been sowed. And the birds up on the wires and the telegraph poles, they can always fly away from this rain and this cold. You can hear them singing out the telegraph code all the way down the telegraph road.
If you had a technology that is small, then that technology can use small sources of energy, extremely relevant to the whole energy problem. You could heat this building with solar energy, but you can't heat the Rockefeller Center with solar energy. Wouldn't even propel the lifts. If you have a small-scale technology, of course, most of your ecological problems disappear, because nature has tolerance margins, and little skirmishes with nature, she can deal with it, but massive assaults, that she can't deal with. If you had a small-scale technology, and only if you have a small-scale technology, can you get a better distribution of population. The fact that roughly 70% of the population of this country live in cities, which between them cover just over 1% of the surface area of the country, entails, of course, enormous energy usage, but cannot be overcome with the existing technology, because it's been produced by the existing technology. So the precondition of any kind of decentralization of the population, smaller towns, a better structure, villages around the market center, market centers around a major town, ideally no major town more than a couple of 100,000 or thereabouts. Everything more is an encumbrance and doesn't serve the human spirit at all. But it's no use talking about decentralization unless one incarnates it in the flesh and creates the wherewithal, the means of doing so.
Thank you. That's why we've been speaking about an intermediate technology, something much more normal, human, and non-violent. We have drifted into extremely violent technologies in the last 50 or so years. We use very poisonous substances in order to be able to continue building rooms like this where all natural light is carefully excluded. And if they forget to put air into the room, then it's very difficult to survive. In order to go on like that, we are prepared to use the most violent methods of energy creation, involving even the creation of plutonium, a substance of such ghastliness that the good Lord never made it. He knew where to stop.
When you crack the sky, scrapers fill the air. But will you keep on building higher till there's no more room up there? Will you make us laugh? Will you make us cry? Will you tell us when to live? Will you tell us when to die? I know we've come a long way. We're changing day to day. But tell me, where do the children play?
Now, if you take all this together, then I would suggest that the possibilities of any real change, not in the talking but in the doing, can only possibly come from small groups of people. So, in a sense, we don't really need a theory of decentralization. The dinosaurs, they will collapse under their own weight. The only way to look at them is they're paper tigers. And they have gone through this evolution just like the dinosaurs, and they will end the same way. Let's hope it won't be an ice age. But innovating minorities, they're always small and are ipso facto decentralized. If any one of us still expects any real help from big, powerful organizations, I suggest we're wasting our time. These organizations are big and powerful precisely because they are not, in this sense, innovating. So the best is to forget them.